Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So
like
you could just see $600,000
deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22 million.
Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every packed check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government, plus I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. Mm. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. Is who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven, the radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah. I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Okay, today, our podcast, we're continuing on from yesterday. We're titled, yesterday's podcast was titled Turning $120,000 Liability into a $1 million Asset. This is part one. Now, yeah, we did the introduction yesterday. Today we're doing part one. And this is really carries over from earlier in the week. So, which... the primary theme is how to take a liability or what you consider a liability and turn it into an asset. Once again, as a reminder, the words asset, liability, and opportunities, all in how you think. It's all in your mind. Just like beauty, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Okay. So a liability, if you reframe it, can become an opportunity, and it's an opportunity to turn it into an asset. All right? So that's what we're concentrating on. We're going to take another step today or make it more plain. On that note, let's listen to a clip from Oprah, and let's reframe that.
As the sun rises over the Arabian Sea on the coastal city of Mumbai, the day is beginning for the 10 million people who live in the crowded city slums. The Hegre family lives in the Kalaba slum in this tiny 10 by 10 foot concrete room. The 60 neighbors who live on their small lane all share just four toilets and this small room for bathing. The Hegres' three daughters, six-year-old twins Anisha and Tanisha, and 12-year-old big sister Anchal, are up early getting ready for school. Their mother, Parvati, helps get the girls and her husband, Rajesh, out the door. After their dad drops the girls off at school, he heads to his job at a security company where he earns about $200 a month. Then Parvati cleans their house, makes lunch and dinner, and performs her daily prayers. Then the most important task of all, she collects the next day's supply of water. In this slum, water only flows during a two-hour window, just once a day.
I felt that you can't come to India without experiencing what we've all heard about the poverty. But I also wanted to frame that story in such a way that it represented the truth of the people.
Anchal? Yeah.
I think this is so wonderful that you're giving me the tour guide. You speak English so well. So it wasn't just people living in slums, eating out of the trash piles and not having a place to defecate and all the stuff that comes with being extremely, extremely poor. But for me, every story is about the heart of the people. And so what is the heart of the people? How do you find a story that shows somebody who is living a life of sparseness, of poverty, but also still has the heart? Thank you. Namaste.
Namaste.
Namaste. Great. All right, we're going here?
Yeah.
All right, thank you. Namaste.
Namaste.
Namaste. Showers of blessings. Oh, thank you.
Namaste.
Namaste. Thank you, family. Thank you. I have to tell you, when I stepped in the door, I was thinking, okay, where is the house? Okay, where's the rest of the house? And then I realized I was already in it.
All right, everybody quiet, please.
Okay, I wanted to start off by just saying thank you for allowing me into your home. How long have you lived in this home?
Living for 33 years.
33 years?
Yeah.
You don't look 33 years old, but you've lived here your whole life?
Yeah.
So your family was here before?
Yeah, my family is also here.
In this space?
Yes, this space.
And this is the entire space. The entire family lives and sleeps in this space. One, two, three, four, five of you sleep in this room.
In this room.
You eat in this room. You play in this room. You share family time together in this room, which is from here to here. The five of you.
Yeah.
Okay. This may be an obvious question, and I don't mean to be offensive, but does it ever feel crowded? Does it feel crowded?
No.
It doesn't feel crowded.
No, we just manage it. We have a habit of sleeping because we don't feel anything.
You don't feel anything?
Yeah.
And how do you do it? I mean, how do you physically do it?
I sleep in that corner.
Where I am right now?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And she sleeps over here, my mother over here, my another sister over here, and my father over here.
Okay. All right. Would you say this is... Is this a hard life? Is it difficult?
Yes, ma'am.
It is.
Yeah.
And tell me what's the most difficult thing about it.
Difficult work, tell my ki mother work aayegi, maja family illa he karega.
Means he has a problem at that he cannot manage his salary enough for four people.
For the people.
Yeah.
This was an arranged marriage, right?
Yeah.
It was an arranged marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did it turn into a love marriage?
After 1 year, I love it.
After 1 year,
yeah.
you love it. Is he a good partner?
Yeah, very good partner.
Good partner.
Yeah.
Do you have a good life with him?
Yeah, very nice life.
I recently renovated this 100 square foot building into a cozy tiny home. And in this video, I'll show you around and break down the cost along the way. So, let's get started. You enter the property from the side because the building is located in my garden, detached from the main house here in the east of England. I've lived in the house for 4 years, but it's currently undergoing some major renovations, so the tiny house gives me somewhere to live in the meantime. When the house is finished, I'll be renting it out, so this tiny space will serve as storage for my stuff, as I'll be moving away for a while. The extra tall fence can make the space feel darker, but will provide privacy to the tenants if ever I need to come and collect something. Now, you enter the tiny home via this lobby, which feels surprisingly spacious thanks to the wall-to-wall floor mat. When paired with these wall-hung shoe storage boxes, it really helps to maximize the space, and if they are any deeper, I'll be walking into them all the time. With the coat and key racks finishing off the space, and the total cost of everything in this room, from the floor mat, the shoe storage, and the coat rack, was just £121. Not a bad start for this budget build, which I gave myself around £8,500 for. Now, as we take the long walk into the bathroom, it's worth mentioning that there was no running water in this building at all when the renovation started, so that was a significant extra cost.
Now, of course, this is a small bathroom, but the shower feels incredibly spacious, and this wall was actually moved back in order to achieve this,
which allows for a much more relaxing shower for someone as tall as me, and much more legroom when using the loo. The cost of this room was just over £1,100 in materials and £4,000 in labour, for a total of £5,124, which is where the majority of the budget for this entire renovation went. But you may have noticed there's no sink, which means washing your hands in the kitchen. A small space calls for a small kitchen, and that's exactly what I've done here. But despite that, there's still plenty of room to store, prep, and cook food at home. There's no oven in here, but I rarely use one anyway, and this 4-burner cooktop is more than enough to cook all of my meals, and the microwave is great for reheating any leftovers. The angled extractor fan is compact, which allows me to see what I'm cooking, whilst the smaller fridge allows room on top and down the side to store more things. Now, I think upgrading this toaster to an air fryer would be a huge upgrade for this kitchen, but I want to know what you think, so let me know in the comments below what you think would be the biggest upgrade to this kitchen. Oh, and I almost forgot to mention that these two walls are magnetic whiteboards, which I use all the time to make notes, plan my days, and make lists of things I need to do. To heat the space, I use this electric radiator, because I didn't want to run any gas lines into the property, as that would have massively increased cost. As for keeping it cool, I just have to open the window and the door, and the place will cool down within minutes. The cost of this kitchen is a little more complicated, because I had the worked up and splashback already from a different project. I also got a few things from Facebook Marketplace to help keep the cost down, such as the cooktop, extractor fan, and even the tap. In total though, it cost me just under £1,300, and if you added a little bit more for the bits I got for free, you could look to spend around £1,700 in order to achieve a similar look. Finishing off the kitchen, I have this floor-to-ceiling cupboard, which stores the majority of my possessions. Paring down from a 3-bed house to a 7-shelf cupboard did take some time, but it was something I was going to need to do anyway before the end of the year when I move away. And now we get to where I spend most of my days, the office. I wanted this area to feel more luxurious and professional, as I knew I'd be spending the majority of my time here, as a software engineer during the day and a wannabe YouTuber at night. So that's why I chose to make the desk out of a piece of solid oak from an old dining table which I found on Facebook Marketplace, which, when combined with the sit-stand desk frame, gives a lot of flexibility when working. The dual monitors are mounted to this stand, which looks much cleaner than just keeping them both on the desk, and more importantly, it provides a lot more space for everything else. This space will be getting even cleaner soon too, as this PC has just been replaced by my new personal laptop, which is a significant upgrade over my 12-year-old PC. And the reason I could afford this upgrade is because of you. By watching my previous video and subscribing, I managed to unlock monetization. And with that first video payslip, I upgraded my setup in order to make better videos. So if you have enjoyed this video so far, please consider subscribing, pressing the bell icon, and why not like the video while you're down there too. It's really helping the channel a lot in these early days. Thank you. As for the cost of everything in this office, I spent just £301. Now, I know what a lot of you are thinking. Why did I use such a dark color in this tiny space? And look, I get it. This was the first space I ever designed myself from start to finish, and I learned a lot about interior design along the way. However, even after living in here for 6 months, I still absolutely love this blue. It may not be for everybody, but for me, it works, and it's never made the space feel claustrophobic at all. If I'm not out and about, this is where I spend most of my evenings. And whilst I don't use the sofa in this mode too much, when it's set up as a recliner, it becomes a perfect hangout space.
Okay, relaxing,
playing games, and watching TV. Speaking of, I have this 49-inch LG TV mounted to the wall, which may seem like it's at a terrible viewing angle, but it is actually on this extendable mount, so the entire TV pulls out and rotates 90 degrees, so that you can see it while sitting on the sofa. In fact, you can rotate this TV any way you like. You can watch TV whilst cooking.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died, and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, we have a problem. She had found on...
Okay, boy, weirdness. But that happens occasionally. Online calls drop or what have you. Boy, goes wicky-wacky, or sometimes it crashes. Today, we're on... We did the introduction yesterday. Actually, a two-day introduction. So today we call this turning $120,000 liability into a $1 million asset. Now, this is something some of you might need to, you might need it right now. So we're going to lay out our strategy. We're going to replay part of the Steve Harvey thing where he had to pay back $650,000 a month. We're going to take that and then apply it to, I don't know where Reba's at, but the example that Reba put out there on how we can do this, or how anybody can do this, and how we are doing this.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005, and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died, and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, we have a problem. She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So
like
you could just see $600,000
deducted.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was my lawyer called me and said, hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here. Oh, man. He said, this woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you're going to jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes pay his current taxes and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, I said, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for two straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus,
LA, there's something wrong with your sound. LA, there's something wrong with your sound.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008.
By the time you met Blondon, how big were you getting? Like, how much were you buying on a regular basis?
Oh, no, maybe a couple pounds, 16 pounds maybe.
16 pounds.
Yeah, 8 pounds, something like that. Okay. At that time, pounds were going for...
Okay, Daryl, thank you. I had myself on mute. Okay. So, Daryl, if you can hear me or anybody else, send me a text. Okay. Yeah, Daryl, send me a text if you can hear me. Now, I had myself on mute, and I forgot to take myself off of mute. And then I'll just repeat what I was saying. Wait a minute. What's coming in? Oh, wait a minute. Let me do it this way.
Can you hear me,
okay.
Ellie?
Yeah. I can hear you now. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. But for a good while, you was, yeah.
Yeah, you know what? That was my fault. I put myself on mute, and I forgot to unmute myself. So thank you for letting me know. All right, let me repeat what I was saying. Well, let me go back to my math numbers again. So. let's take the figure. All right. Well, let's start off with Steve Harvey. Steve Harvey had to pay $650,000 a month. So let's just break that down. $650,000 a month divided by 30 days in the month. That means that Steve Harvey would have to come up with $21,666 per day. That's a less intimidating number than $650,000 a month. Still, $21,000 in a day is a lot of money. So let's break it down. As a matter of fact, let's go a little bit further. $650,000 a month. Now, Steve Harvey, now once again, three words, very important. Asset, liability, and opportunity. All are states of mind. How we see things, and like beauty, what is an asset, what is a liability, and what is an opportunity are all in the mind of the beholder. All right, so in this case, to most people, having to pay back $650,000 per month with the possibility of not paying back and you got to go to jail or lose everything, that's a liability. However, Steve Harvey looked at it as an opportunity to create an asset or assets that can bring him in the amount of money he needed to extinguish that $650,000 per month liability. Now, if you go online, and I want you guys to do this, go online right now, search engine, Steve Harvey Morning Show, and what you also want to find out is the number of radio stations that the Steve Harvey Morning Show is on. I'm going to put the number at 100. All right? So Steve created an asset called the Steve Harvey Morning Show, and he was able to get that his radio talk show onto 100 radio stations. And each one of those radio stations has a sales team. All right? So let's take $650,000 and divide it by 100 radio stations, 100 assets, and or $650,000 a month divided by 100. That means that each one of those, he would have to generate at least $6,500 per station. Now, let's divide that by 20 days in a month, 20 working days in a month, taking weekends off. That's $325 per day. By creating that asset in which he was able to take on partnerships, then he didn't have to have he left by himself that $650,000 per month. So let's apply the same principle to $120,000 liability that Reba mentioned a few days ago. So $120,000. Now, let's divide that by 120,000. Let's divide that by 20 working days. Let's do it by 24 working days in a month, working Monday through Saturday and taking days off or whatever. You need to, if you don't take Sunday off, take Saturday off. It's up to you. All right, so 120,000 divided by 24 working days a month, that's $5,000 per day. Seven people within an 8-hour period of time, because you got 24 hours in the day, can build one tiny house, all right? So you build one tiny house per day, let's say you build it for five, but you're going to sell it, you want to clear a $5,000 profit. So $5,000 times six houses that you built in a week, there's one a day, Matter of fact, hold it. This is who sent me. Okay, thanks, Daryl. And I'm opening up your mic in a moment so you can share that. $5,000 times a day times 6 days a week, that's $30,000. $30,000 per week, $120,000 per month, and that's what we're doing here, with your help, one day at a time. Now, seven, 8, 1. Let's look at this. We said, then I'm gonna open up your mic, Daryl, or anybody else that wants to chime in. Matter of fact, before I even open it, two things I want to do. Number one, we said let's take 8 hours and 6 days a week. That's 48 hours. So in 48 hours, we have established that we can build six tiny houses. And the average work week, let's see, 8 hours times five is 40 hours a week. All right, so we said 8 times 6 is 48. But let's see, there are 24 hours in the day. And let's see, in 6 days you got 144 hours. So out of the 144 hours that we have in 6 days, minus 48, that leaves 96 hours left over. We can generate $30,000 within 48 hours or less. Okay. In any event, that's doable. That's doable. Let me open up the mics real quick. Daryl, you have something to share with us?
Yeah, I'm still here with you. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you clear.
I looked up his morning show, but when I looked at it, this is what it says. It says, how much does Steve Harvey make for Judge Steve Harvey? I never knew he was a judge. I never knew he had a judge show. And right after that, I said, well, it's not clear how much Harvey gets paid for the judge of Steve Harvey. We at least know that his radio hosting gig is extremely lucrative. He reportedly makes around $20 million per year. For this syndicate morning show, January 2nd, 2024. That's what they say. They also have a number he can be reached at. His number. But you know the strange thing about it, when he said his lawyer was his tax people was in cahoots. But in cahoots with who? You know, he said that. But I wonder who's in cahoots. I mean, somebody should be held liable for that, what happened, and he should be off the hook for that. Because, you know, it wasn't something he would do, and I'm sure all these people, someone are still breathing air on this side, you know? But he has a number. Maybe he wouldn't mind coming on the show. But one thing I want to ask you, L.A., so like the 7-8-1 rule, right? Yeah, it's like 7 people, right. 8 hours, 1 house a day. Now, so like the trade person, you'll have a carpenter, you'll have a plumber, you'll have an electrician, you'll have the laborer, I guess you have the people who paint. I don't know that the laborers, I don't know what other duties they will perform. But so you said like you have the carpenter. Okay, the carpenter, they could do like the roofing and stuff like that too. But you have some special people who are just made for roofing. So you have the cement person, like the foundation, and I guess you have the architect. You would do the architect too. So out there, 7 people we would need. What would their positions be? Would one cover the other one, or their position would be specific?
Well, when you got 7 people, you only basically need one skilled person. You basically just need one skilled person, and the other 6 people are basically helpers and assemblers. The carpenter builds, the carpenter's going to need at least 1 or 2 people to help him build a particular part or prefab, a part of a building, a wall, floor, or a roof. All right.
Okay.
And then the other people basically help assemble the building once those parts are actually built.
Okay.
And out of that 7-8-1, out of that 7, depends on what kind of system they put together, you can have 4 people, 4 people that are working on building each part, or you can split it up. All right. 2 people, they work on, let's say, walls. Then you got and that leaves you with 3 people. The other you got 1 person that's a floater, and then you can have another 2 people working on the roof or the doors or the windows or what have you. So it all depends on which way they want to organize. See, that's why I brought up mathematics the other day. using the zero, that's the figures zero, the digits rather, zero through nine, just those 10 digits. You know, we've got billions of telephone numbers globally speaking. And it, just look at your, I mean, well, using the telephone number of this program, 619-768-2945. Now, once again, there is
11 numbers.
There's only, well, no, no, 10 digits. But, all right, 619, you know, the zero's not mentioned, two's not mentioned, three's not mentioned, four's not mentioned, five's not mentioned, seven or eight. None of, just 619, that's the first of these digits of this call-in number. Then we go to the next combination of numbers, 786. All right, you know, and then the last four digits, 2945. So it's the same thing when it comes to how many ways, how many combinations, or how many functions can your seven people decide on what to do. Now, we said 8 hours. Seven people, once you get a system going, because we're talking about fundamentally, if we're talking about a basic bread and butter house, it basically has four walls, a floor, and a roof. That's it. We're talking four, five, six. There's six fundamental parts to a roof, six fundamental parts to a castle, six fundamental parts to a skyscraper. We're talking about the fundamental parts. So in our case, when we're talking about tiny buildings, I mean houses, all right, we're talking about like, look, and I'm about to play it now, solar cabin. Lamar Alexander built his house, six fundamental parts, by himself in 2 weeks, 14 days. So if you've got seven people, and once you have a system down, you can probably build that house in an hour or two. You know, once you, you know, once everybody has their roles, that's where the, you know, the assembly plant, like, I, for instance, Toyota, you know, at first with Ford's Model T, it used to take maybe 2 months to build one Model T car. But then when Henry Ford applied the assembly factory assembly line model, you know, he got it down to 12 hours, down to 6 hours. And now, like, somebody like Toyota makes 29.9 cars per minute. The average Toyota vehicle has 30,000 parts.
Now, I want to
Go ahead.
Now, you said, like, one of your houses were, like, okay, like $10,000. I think what we make, we kind of, like, double the money back, like, five weeks.
Right, yeah, if you build it for five and you sell it, and you sell it for 10, because 10 is a reasonable sweet spot number where a lot of people can put their hands on. So that's why I'm saying it. Okay, go ahead.
I did the math. Okay, this is what I did, right? Because now we only did 8 hours, but we talked about 24 hours, right? So what I did,
that's what we just talked about, 8 hours.
Yeah. So what I said, what happens if you could feel like, you know, you have the morning shift, the afternoon shift, and then the night shift. Every shift is doing 8 hours, right? And then so like
right.
After the house is completed, right?
So that means we're building a bare minimum. Oh, Daryl, that means we're building bare minimum three houses a day.
Yes. So what I did, the math I came up, before I keep on jumping off, give me a second, let me open it back up. So what I did,
right.
I divided $10,000 into 21 people, right? And
right. Because
seven times three is 21. So it's so like per day, they like so like you could pay each of them 21 people, you could pay them $476 if they want to make that per day.
or, you know, or you can, like, you know, lower it, because, like, engineers, they make about, like, about that much. Like, you know, some engineers, they make about, you know, $400-$300 a day. And so if you want to lessen it, say, hey, you pay the guys, like, less than that. And then, like, you get some of the materials. So, like, if you was to pay them, like, maybe $276, and then you use, like, the $200 for, like, material, you know, to frame the house, to get the sheetrock. And so it might, the three houses may have to become complete, right? Because, see, like, three houses is $30,000. Well, if one house is $10,000. So, like, so putting up three houses in one day, we have more than enough to get the material and more than enough to still pay the guys, you know, that much. You know, because only $10,000 will actually pay them $476. But then again, like
right.
like you spent $15,000, right? $15,000 for
right.
The material, right? And then you still have like $15,000 for the material, but then you still have like okay. Then you still have like $30,000. So now $15,000. So that's like maybe $5,000. So if you sell it for like $15,000 for the material, that's for three houses, right? And you're making $10,000 off
right.
it. So that means, and then you're only paying them like, so it's like 1,000 profit. You're making like more than 5,000 profit. Let me see, like that. I'm getting this math a little confused. Let me slow down a little bit. I'm talking a little too fast. So now you build three houses in one day, right? Three houses in one day. So now
yeah.
that's $10,000. That's $10,000, right? $10,000
per house.
A couple of but you can take $10,000 per house, right? Okay, $10,000 for a house. Okay, let me see, like five.
That's $30,000. That's $30,000 a day.
Yeah, but even if I was to break it down, because now that's well, say like $5,000. So $5,000 that would be of $200 and about $30-something you pay the guys, and still be able to put up your house. To be able to put up your
right.
house with that, you know? So you make a penny like that. Do you want the precise numbers?
I tell you what, Daryl, work that out. I'm going to play this real clip because I got to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back with the numbers because I'm glad you brought that up, particularly if we did it, you know, we had three shifts a day. Because, once again, Toyota pumps out 29.9 cars per minute. So if they with 30,000 parts. Each car has 30,000 parts. So add that up for me, Daryl, and then we're going to come back and we'll get right back to you on that.
Okay.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second, and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land, okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is.
Okay, so as we're getting ready to go to Daryl on these figures. All right. Now, and Daryl, I'm glad you brought it up. If we worked in shifts, if we take 781 and did it in shifts, okay, building three in a day, all right, and let's say we, let's look at our production. Three times six, that's 36 houses per week. And let's say we made $5,000 profit on average per house. That's $180,000 in a week. Once again, how to turn a liability into an asset. And basically, this is the model that we're going to be dealing with. Daryl, let's go back to you. Give us the figures you came up with.
Okay, this is what I did. A 24-hour shift that would be broken into three shifts. The workers would be paid. The 21 workers, they would be paid $283 per shift, right? So now the total for 21 workers for the whole 24 hours, the total is $5,000. So like that $5,000 right there will cover the 24-hour worth of working, 21 people working. And after they complete the house, then you have a $15,000 profit. After they complete the three houses, that's a $15,000 profit. Cause
hold
they
on,
put
did
$5,000
you deduct? Did you deduct the $5,000 per house?
I deduct the $5,000 for the materials. I deduct that. So after all three houses get completed, then that's $15,000. So 15 times six, right? 15 times
right.
six. So that would be 90,000.
Okay, let me tell you this while it's on my mind, Daryl. We're going to keep on doing this live stream now because everything we're doing is recorded for archives. But me and you touch bases on this at least 5 days a week because
okay,
I want to take
now.
What
I
you're saying. I like the way you think. I like the way you think. Well, I want to take what you're saying and be my accountability partner, at least one of my accountability partners, where we actually put what you're saying into motion. Anyway, continue with the figures.
Yes. So B-Night is going to be 6 days a week. So you have three times six, that's 18, right? Okay, 18. Three times six is 18. So 18 times three times, because it's three houses a day, right? And it's 6 days a week, so that's 18. So 18 times 5,000. Hey, 18 times five. So you got that's a zero, and that's like I said, it's 90.
Right.
So that's 90,000 for 6 days, and so in 6 days, that's 90,000. after all the houses are sold, after 18 times 6 houses are sold. So, three times 6 is 18. So after all the 18 houses are sold, that's 90,000 after all the material and after everybody's paid. So per week,
right.
That's 90,000 per week. Because from there, like,
okay.
Per house, right? Yeah, so for one day, it's going to cost $5,000 to cover 21 people working at the rate. So each worker is going to be, after their shift is over, they're going to be paid $283 per day, right? So every day,
okay,
they're going to get
paid. Okay, that's good money.
Every day, they're going to get paid $283, right? So they're going to get paid that for, like, 6 days. Right? So
right.
They're going
right.
to get paid that for 6 days. Yes. Uh-huh. And at the end of that week, after everything.
Well, what
else,
we could do now, Daryl, that's one way because you got three in a shift now. There's 3 8-hour shifts now. There's another guy that I know of. What he does is he averages anywhere to 3 to 5 orders a day. So he works his workers. You know, like regular 9-to-5 shifts or 10-to-6 or something like that. And he has them all working during primarily business hours, traditional business hours. But they all, in other words, if he's got 3 orders, he's got 7 people per house. So we can take the same figures that you have. Instead of working a 24-hour shift, okay, we can have 3 projects going on during the same shift. That's another combination
okay.
of way, you know, to spend it as well. But I'm glad you are thinking the way you're thinking because what you mentioned is that's doable. That's doable. And man, I'm ready to get started on that right now because basically the way you worked it out, a person can essentially knock out a debt like that within a week, 2 weeks tops.
And the good thing about it is you said during the daytime because you can see a lot of things better during the daytime anyway because, you won't have to worry about the light.
Yeah, plus
if
you need materials
yeah.
or anything, you can go get it. You can get it during regular business hours versus, you know, if it's at night or something like that. Places are closed. So, all right, that's another idea we get. We need to keep it during regular hours and then have more than one crew. In other words, we can have more than one 7-8-1 crew.
Now, one thing I know, like sometimes you believe in like the bartering system, but I feel like if you have something like revolving credit, so like these guys see you putting up these projects, and they have like because they talk about the market housing, nobody buying houses and stuff like that, and then if it's probably most likely they'll give you this thing or I guess cold consignment or whatever, they'll give you the lumber. They give you all the building material, and then once everything gets sold, you just pay them off. Sometimes these places act like that when you're a good customer. Like if you like to know the neighborhood or lumber yard or you need to know the neighborhood electrical people, sometimes they'll give you these things, or they'll front you them till everything gets finished. As long as that person's trustworthy, you know. You build up a good rapport.
Yeah, that's true. That's a very good idea. That way you don't need to come up with actually, if you get a system like that going, you don't need to have that outlay of cash like that. So you make a very good point.
Yeah, because, see, one thing, it's better getting it off the shelf than it's sitting on the shelf and don't having any customers. So, they're like, as long as I know, like, hey, money's going to start coming in because a lot of times you go to this place and nobody's buying any home improvement stuff. People don't have the money. But if they see that you're getting this stuff, they know you're going to have the money. So a lot of people, they'll take a chance.
Right.
And, you know.
Well,
All right, I'm putting out a goal then that instead of just having one 70 crew, we formulate what we can do with three, and then, of course, we start off with one. And then, because after that team gets the system down, because, you know, once you get a system down, you're not going to need 8 hours to build a tiny house.
And
you know, that 8 hours can collapse. That can collapse down to 2 hours.
Yes.
You were saying there.
L.A., one day a few years ago, we talked about, like, pies in the church and everything like that. You remember? Like, remember we talked about the dollar buses a few years ago? This was about, like, maybe, like, 4 years ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I remember that, yeah.
And see, at this construction site, people got to eat. So now not only they working there, so we can set up something where they can buy food from the local people. Like, you know, instead of going, like, far to the guy down the corner, we could keep the money circling. You know how we say, like, the money could bounce 18 times in our community? It could bounce around our workers, you know? The money could bounce
right
between our workers. Instead of you spending money to that guy down the store, you spending money between, because you know, whoever's putting up the project, they have a little food, some type of food business. You know, like, you know, maybe they would make something healthy, like lemonade, you know, because lemonade is just regular water, lemon or lime. And if you use a guave is very good. It's not like you look at some of the ingredients and you have 10 ingredients on the can. So you have basically three simple ingredients, water, lemon or lime, and then a guave, and it's more healthier. So, and I'd say, like you said, well, I'm going to sell it like 50 cents a cup. Yeah, you know, how much does a store charge?
Right.
A dollar, $2. So now they can send more nutritional, and they get it like, and we're going to give them a bigger cup. We're not going to give them any 16 ounce. We're not going to give them any 20 ounce. We're going to give them like a 32 size one of them plastic containers like that. And, you know, you can't beat that for like, a dollar, you know, and you get a refill
right
too. So you like that, you get the refill. Like, hey, you want something to drink? Hey, refill. That, you know.
Well, Daryl, I definitely like the way you think. We're going to follow your lead on this, starting immediately.
Yeah.
And
LA, I want you to see.
Go ahead, I'm listening.
I want you to see how much is a 40-pound chicken leg, a box of quarters from the part of town where you at. A box of quarter leg for chicken, like that, you know, the thigh, the leg, and the back. And see how much
okay.
In New York, it costs about $25. Well, a lot of time in boxes, you know, some people don't like the back. Some people like the thigh, so, you know. And then from there, you can cut them up into sections, and that little, like, the little $25 it costs over here in New York, you could stretch that thing out to over 100 plus. Just that $25 box. There's so many ways you could make that $25 into curry chicken, to barbecue chicken, to baked chicken, to stewed chicken, to fried chicken. You know, there's so many ways that you can turn that $25 easy into $300 plus. You know? And, yes. Offer $25.
That's one way that people that's one way people do earn money.
Cooking, yeah. Everybody gotta eat.
That's true. And also I'm thinking
Ellie, I wanna tell you a story. Remember I told you I was in the shelter, right? Elliot, are you there?
Take refreshments in a meal break.
I want to tell you an amazing story. Are you there, Ellie? Can you hear me? Going out again.
I say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to... Say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars these is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back out the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. Wow. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family going to live in there? Is they going to... I'm going to get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now... those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you, sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you are driving.
That is true.
Down a superhighway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build little shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch. out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I coming along, I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and beg, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
Okay, well, thanks to YouTube, we can learn things. We can learn carpentry. Think YouTube wipes all that out. When that he recorded that there, there was no YouTube. The figures that Daryl put out here are very doable as well. And let's see, it was something I wanted to play before I open back up the mic. Let me see what's here. No, that's from Freeway Rick Ross. I didn't want to play that. Let's see if it was this one.
Hey there, everyone. My name is Jordan from Happen Films, and this is a $420 tiny house. Let's check it out.
This beautiful structure behind us is the house that we built over the course of about 3 months out of pretty much entirely recycled materials. So the total cost of the house is about $420 if you include the petrol money that went into it.
The size is about 2.5 by 2.5 meters, it's 6.25 square.
We went by dumpsters from demolition sites. We looked on the website Gumtree. We ended up getting pretty much everything we needed to build a whole house just for free.
So we decided to try and build our home with just hand tools.
Yeah, we tried to. We didn't manage to in the end. There were a couple of things that were too difficult for us to do with the tools that we had and the skills that we had.
So we ended up having to use a power drill and an impact driver.
We had to make 5 purchases. We bought some cement for the foundations, some steel bracing tape because it was a bit wonky, some screws for the roof, a little tub of wood glue to make some window frames. We bought chains to hold the windows open. Oh, and we bought the 6 things. We bought some hinges.
So we were using salvaged paper insulation to try and line the whole house, and we ran out. We were just short and we didn't have enough to do the roof. But luckily we found this stuff in a dumpster. We were out a couple of months ago going through the local supermarket dumpsters looking for food, and there was this perfectly new tarp in brand new condition, and it's still in its packet.
I guess we wanted to challenge the idea that you need like a whole lot of high-tech tools and skills and knowledge to be able to build a house. I mean, that house is mostly built with a handsaw and a hammer. I think the main challenge we face is that neither of us has ever really built anything before. Rachel built a chick coop. I built a set of bunk beds once. We had to learn everything as we went. It takes it away a little bit from that professional need a whole lot of tools, need a whole lot of skills and a whole lot of different people. You need someone to lay the foundation, someone to build a frame, someone to paint it. The conventional building methods that are used, it's hard to imagine them being sustained more than 50 or 100 years in the future. Just the amount of resources that they require and the importation of all kinds of things. We acknowledge that this kind of building can't really be sustained either. It's not an indefinitely sustainable technique. But using recycled materials and building much smaller spaces is something that can be sustained for a lot longer into the future. We live on a community, which means there are communal spaces for socialising. We have a communal bathroom, shower. For us, a house is really just a place to be able to have some quiet time in, a place to sleep in, a place to store our personal belongings in.
living a more of a shared communal lifestyle means that we can get away with just a really small house because we don't really need it for all these other things. It's great to have built our own house. It's like more than just having built a house. The house is cool. Yeah, don't get me wrong. It's great. But to have developed the skills and knowledge to do it again and to like share that with other people, I'm just, yeah, chuffed about the amount that I've learned through doing that.
Land ownership can be a huge barrier for people looking to live this way, and some people who see this may think that it isn't possible for them because they can't afford to buy their own land. The community that Liam, Rachel, me, and four others live on is owned by one family, and they allow us to stay on the land rent-free in exchange for developing the property by building infrastructure, planting veggie gardens, and taking care of the place. I feel that more scenarios like this will start to happen, where owners of unused land invite people to live on their property to develop a community and to do something great with the land. The challenge is connecting land owners with people looking to live this way.
Even if you've got no skills and knowledge, you can kind of just do that yourself. And it's much easier, it's much more affordable as well for people like us who don't have a great deal of money. It's much more accessible. I could just kind of build a much smaller space and then share your other spaces with other people.
Okay, well, they built, now, they took them 3 months, but what they did was they essentially harvested a lot of their materials. They spent, including gas money, $420. So that's possible. But if you want to do it, as we're talking about, on a commercial level where, you know, you have to get a constant thing of supplies and, you know, fresh lumber and all that type of thing, you know, you're going to spend the figures that Daryl has put out. Daryl, anything that you want to add on before we close out for today? We're going to continue this tomorrow because tomorrow we're going to lay out dates. Tomorrow we're going to put together a formalized plan based on the figures that you gave out today. So anything else you want to add on for today, Daryl?
No, Ellie, that would be good. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah, Ellie, I can hear you. I can hear you clear.
That would be good.
Yeah, I can hear you.
That would be good.
Okay. All right. Then on that note, Daryl, talk to you tomorrow. Everyone have a good rest of the day.
I'll talk to you tomorrow.